their country going into it. When he steps out onto British UK land outside of the embassy, he can be arrested. And there's cops sitting there right as we speak saying, we're going to arrest him. So at that point, he either needs a safe passage from the UK, which seems at this point unlikely. Of course, we never know in these situations. Or your thought of giving him citizenship, perhaps that would work. Or, you know, we thought, you know, he could go into a embassy car with one of those little flags you see all the time and then drive to the airport and then run into the airplane. Well, that's probably not so great because the Vienna Convention, unlikely, well, we don't know, doesn't really necessarily can have the same efficacy with regard to a car and, you know, has to get out on the tarmac and all that. So the two proposals on now we have in front of us are yours, which is interesting, to say the least, and the other one, and I think yours may be more likely than getting him a safe conduct, but you never know. You know, there's a history to this kind of stuff. If you look through the pages, particularly during the Cold War, when people who opposed various, you know, various governments, particularly in the Soviet Union or allied countries, one in Hungary in particular, Cardinal Maczynski, whatever people thought of Cardinal Maczynski, he went into a U.S. embassy in Hungary and stayed there for 14 or 15 years, lived in the embassy, and finally Hungary gave him a safe passage out of the country. So these things are, you don't know how it's going to come out. And I think that's, it's going to make an interesting story. But, you know, the thing you know is, we know how it would have come out had he gone to Sweden. And I don't mean about the Sweden abuse charges, because those, serious as they might be, and none of us know, because there hasn't been a trial yet, and you have to presume him innocent until there's a trial. But serious as those might or might not be, they just pale in comparison to what would have happened to him if the United States gets its hands on him, both in the conditions of his confinement, which if you look at Bradley Manning, who was tortured while he was in confinement, and in what would have happened to him at trial. So he made, of the bad choices he had, he probably made the one that made the most sense for himself.
Well, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights and of Law and Disorder, I thank you so much today for so well representing, both on 5 o'clock Shadow and in the courts, your client, Julian Assange.
Robert Knight, it's always good to talk to you, and pleased you're still with us at WBAI.
All right. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. More after this.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
And this is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Robert Knight, and earlier today we had what we believe to be the first exclusive live interview with the American attorney of WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange about the startling developments overnight of his seeking of asylum in the embassy of the nation of Ecuador, where sometime earlier President Correa had stated that he would be welcome to live in peace there. Julian Assange is in a very odd and discriminatory position because there is no indictment against him over sexual allegations made by two women in Sweden. So the merits of the extradition are questionable, and the Swedish authorities say that they merely want to question him, but they could have done that by simply coming to England, where he was under house arrest, without the necessary condition of his being extradited from the United Kingdom to Sweden, where early on in this complex controversy, our guest that you just heard, the great attorney, Michael Ratner, tweeted upon his surprise awareness of the breaking events just a short time ago, prior to our interview on 5 o'clock shadow. According to WikiLeaks Central, Julian Assange's U.S.-based lawyer Michael Ratner commented on the request via Twitter. And before we interviewed Michael Ratner, our friend and esteemed colleague, who thinks I ought to be on the legal team because I thought of how to get him out diplomatically. But nevertheless, Michael Ratner, initially, upon the surprise of the world about this situation, tweeted the following. Julian's asylum, not about questioning in Sweden. Stop. Facing life in solitary in U.S. with no COMM period for exposing war crimes period. What would you do? Query, query, query. Sweden easier. Smaller. Lawyers in United Kingdom, remarkable. More public support. He, Assange, would be in jail in Sweden. U.S. lodges warrant, and he never is out. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks to the generosity of Julian Assange's American lawyer, Michael Ratner, and the tradition that you have supported here on WBAI for truth, revelation, and justice in regard to the secret operations of the government for which you pay. This is a seminal moment. I don't think anyone else has had such an inside legal opinion or statement than you have made possible with 5 o'clock shadow, and here we reiterate it tonight on Earthwatch. So thank you all very much for every moment of support that you've given to WBAI, because we are in a war of information, and you are on our side. I would have said we're on your side, but that's patronizing or matronizing. We're going to take some phone calls, because this is fast-breaking news. I'll try and get updates as the program continues. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. Also do 5 o'clock shadow, the investigative news magazine. And the phone number here is 212-209-2900. And this here is Earthwatch. and we get to talk about things in a less formal way tonight, and you're on the air. Hello? Are you there? Hello? This is Earthwatch. We'll take the next call. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah.
Robert?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Bob Fass.
Bob, I so much wanted to talk to you tonight. Oh, thank you.
Let me turn my radio down.
Who gets to tell Bob Fass to turn his damn radio down? Oh, I feel so good. Thank you, Bob.
I was listening this afternoon to you when you were on with Michael Ratner, and I felt like such a shiver go down my back, such a like a feeling of apprehension. And then I remembered that even though Michael Ratner had been talking about how if Julian Assange, he did represent Julian Assange, he wouldn't be allowed to report on the trial. He wouldn't be allowed to tell anyone outside of the military tribunal that would try him what was actually going on in the trial. And then I was relieved when the station went off the air for about 5 minutes to remember that WBAI has such inept engineers and such inept engineering that, well, you know, it could be just, you know, a question of the money not being there to pay for repairing the equipment or whatever it was. But it was a chilling moment, Robert, when you went off after Ratner said that. And I got a call tonight.
Bob, I did not know that.
That you went off the air?
You mean the terrestrial FM signal discontinuity'd?
Well, you might say it that way if you wanted to use words of six syllables when words of two syllables would do.
They shut us down?
We were shut down for, at least 5 minutes, at least in this area.
At what point of the interview? No, I did not know that, Bob.
I was listening on FM, and maybe the online signal was going out over FM for a while. At any rate, what's happening to Julian Assange is such a clearly put-up job, you know. When they go into the bedroom, you can almost always be sure that they're...
Bed bugs.
What?
Bed bugs.
What's that?
Bed bugs.
Well, whatever the reason, Julian Assange did us all a favor. He's right there with John Peter Zenger and Daniel Ellsberg.
Yes, sir.
And I hope you... I hope you can get some of your listeners to hear about Stanley Cohen, who's representing a lot of the people who were arrested downtown. He represented some squatters very successfully, and he's being charged with some kind of technical tax evasion in Syracuse, New York. He's probably going to be indicted. They're attacking the lawyers. They did that in Chile before they came after the population.
They did that in Chicago.
Yep.
Bob, I am so honored
Robert.
To hear your voice, and you are a Peter Zenger in an even more creative way as a progenitor of what we know today as freeform radio. And that you
Robert,
listen to me today
Robert,
is my honor.
When people say you're the father of freeform radio, I wish I'd worn a condom.
Well, you know what it is? It's a paternity suit.
Robert, keep it up.
Don't you dare go away, Bob Fass. This is Earthwatch, and I got you right now. Because I tried to call you earlier, you know. Because of the great moment coming up within a week from today, in which there is the New York premiere of the documentary film about the publishable part of your body of work, of Radio Unnameable. Tell us about that.
Well, Robert, the hero of the film is really the cabal, the listeners. You can see so many of their faces in some of the crowd scenes. It's not really so much about me as about what I've been, the Bob at the gate, as the Sufis say.
You were just there when it happened, huh?
I was just not holding the door open, you know, or holding it closed.
Well, how can you see a cabal on film?
Well, for instance, when there was an action where we cleaned a street on the Lower East Side, there were photographers who were there and captured all of the faces, all of the kids who joined in to clean a whole street from one river to the other. We had announced that we would clean one street, and the Department of Sanitation was very busy. They had cleaned that street for the first time in 10 years the night before we were scheduled to arrive. But we looked around, we saw some other streets on either side of them, and we cleaned there instead.
You have such a subtle genius. I mean, here you are. Honoring me with the call to Earthwatch.
Robert,
you are my
Robert,
hero.
De-escalate your language a bit, will you?
All right, you suck. Okay, how about that?
It makes me feel like you're...
Bob, the first time I was ever on WBAI air was as an idiot when you had a musician on, and I called up all intimidated and proud. And you, my, you know, sharing that... That moment is only a microcosm of
who's the musician.
The Uncle Tom game. It was a long time ago. It'll come to me. But number one got down. Number seven was Uncle Tom. You know that song? It was a long time ago. See, and you innervated me to not fear that place that gave me the comfort you shared with me. And here we are today. And, Bob, it's not just my personal embiggenment that you made possible, but it is also that while I'm here as a catalyst in a moment of international political intrigue and revelation, you yourself held a seminal role in that in another early moment that was very formative in my politics. When you were the man who put up the up-against-the-wall Immer efforts during the... great retrenchment against the Stonewall people.
I was disappointed. I didn't like that when it happened. I thought that was going too far, but I did have to laugh.
You were brilliant.
Like a lot of funny things, it ended in tears and blood. There was a group. It's after 10 o'clock. We can say their name, can't we? The Up Against the Wall Mother...
Mm-hmm.
I guess everybody can think
curse.
Of the other
yes.
word. It sounds like off the hook.
It was a moment, and here's what I'm.
Anyway,
Bob, I got to say this.
Party.
Bob, wait. I got to say this about contemporary moments in politics. I just finished doing national reportage on the silent marches of 2012. Oh, you heard, and 1917, which were. Transformed because of the inclusion of the current march of the lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual community, which was not an easy sell. And you were on that case back in the days of Stonewall. You are awesome, brother.
Well, first silent, I mean, I don't know whether it was the first or not, but the first silent march I ever heard of was the one after the Triangle Shirt Waist Fire, where because the guy who was running the Macaladora in the garment district locked young women in so they wouldn't take, you know, go out on the fire escape to get a breath of fresh air or leave too early. And when the fire struck, it was like that apartment building in Jackson Heights, where the, I think it was Jackson Heights, where the landlord took down all the fire escapes and thereby threw all of his tenants out into the street. You remember that little incident?
Oh, yeah. I heard about shirt waste. I know about that.
Ought to have been some kind of a demonstration then, but I think the Triangle Shirtwaist was a silent march. There were probably silent marches, maybe with drum rolls going back in history. You know, it really brings home the fact that the people who run things don't give a damn about what happens to the 1%, to the 99%, rather. So there's been a lot of blood on the American stage. And, you know, I still feel that nonviolence is the only way to combat that. But people who run things should be aware that there are people who are not of my frame of mind, and who are being pushed to just too far.
The ones who should be kept away from the babies at the picnic.
What's that?
The ones who should be kept away from the babies at the picnic. The dangerous ones. The insecure ones, the violent ones.
Well, keep it up, Robert. And,
I'm going to keep you up. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, broadcasting on the terrestrial band at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at WBAI.org.
I'm sure there are other callers, Robert. Why don't you put some of them on the air?
We're going to get to that, Bob. You ain't done yet. Because I have always, in the creation of my art, admired your improvisationalness. I mean, and you ain't even black.
Well, Robert, maybe on the outside I'm not.
but inside your heart is black, right?
But, you know, it's not really so long ago that we were all Africans. You know, I think the skin is a, you know, it's a marker, but it's not an irreplaceable marker of a person's heart.
Yeah, yeah, it's what Martin was saying: content of character, color of skin. Bob, it is so rare for anyone at WBAI to be consciously heralded as opposed to being subliminally channeled in future consciousness. And you have well beyond deservedly reached that level.
I have to interrupt you right there. See, because I can remember a time when the media, the external media, paid a lot of attention to what was on WBAI, a lot of attention. And the main reason that some of our better programs aren't reported more frequently in the news is because, it could be that we're not reaching out and telling them about it, and it could also be that they're freezing us out. But they know what we're doing. People in newspapers listen to WBAI.
In fact, we inform many of the stories they later report.
Quite true. Quite true.
Well, Bob, your incompleted body of work is being documented at least in some part by a fine new film that's going to be at the BAM Festival coming up within a week. And the film is itself like your show, which is heard 24 hours from now, called Radio Unnameable. And Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson and other people have put together an hour and a half. And I don't know how in hell they could have distilled all the crazy stuff you did. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, 50 years in 87 minutes is almost sounds like a joke, doesn't it? There is an awful lot of stuff, really important stuff, that I think they just didn't find there was a space for in the movie. But they certainly hit the high points, and I'm very happy with what they did with I'm thrilled, really. It's so far it has been at the Full Frame Festival in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina.
Down in my home country.
Sold out both two shows. It was in Sarasota Film Festival, also sold out and won a jury prize. And this next week it's going to be at the Silver Doc Festival in Silver Springs, Maryland. That's, near Washington, D.C.
Bob, as a investigator of the CIA, I think it's Silver Spring with no S.
What's that?
Silver Spring, no S, Maryland. I used to work for Computer Sciences Corporation. I think it's Silver Spring, not Silver Springs.
Could very well be. Could be.
But it's not that far from Langley and Alexandria County, but I'm just saying.
Well, could be. There are also some fine music schools in the area and some very good law schools. And I have an insight about the CIA that I think I got from Daniel Ellsberg. He said that, like any other big bird, it has a left and a right wing, and it can't fly without both, they think.
Brilliant.
So there are... We have friends in the strangest places, you know.
Tell us about the strange observance. I mean, among more than fans, you kind of broke a lot of barriers, brother. Be they sexual, racial, political, broadcast, communicative. What was your most paranoid moment?
My most paranoid moment? I don't know. It was probably when Utrice and her minions were kicking you around.
Good answer.
I remember that. I remember sitting at home and listening and knowing that this maniac was kicking you. I wonder if you remember it.
I didn't much notice.
Poor fellow is dead now. But he was about as far out as a person can be and still managed to show up on time and do a morning show. Well, maybe not as far out.
You make me laugh. You know, that which does not kill you.
What's that?
That which does not kill you merely bleeps you off. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and that is our friend, I'm proud to say, and legend, Bob Fass. And I want to see all of us on the 26th of June at BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, the last place of culture after the invasion of the sports games, with a guy who's named after a subway line. You know who I mean?
No.
Jay-Z? Yeah, subway line. Jay-Z. But no, seriously, the film is called Radio Unnameable.
Documentary.
It is a documentary. How can you put the universe in a ball jar? Well, that's
in
a ball jar. That's a southern thing about preserves, you know. You know, with the two-part lid, you know, flat part, and then you screw it on.
Right.
How can you contain lightning in a bottle? And the film by Paul Lovelace and Jessica Watson.
Wilson. Paul Lovelace. If you corrected my ass, I'll correct your ass.
Well, bleep you. And thank you. By the way, by bleep, I mean thank.
What's that?
When I say bleep you, I mean thank.
Well, thank you very, very much.
So the film is about the radio legend and New York treasure Bob Fass. It's a 87-minute film.
It's about the best audience in the world, the WBAI audience. Long may they listen to our waves.
Well, you'll hate. I'm going to continue reading this, Bob, because I can do that even if you aver. The father of freeform radio has been the host of Radio Unnameable on New York's WBAI for almost 50 years. Directors Lovelace and Wolfson of the Iowa Mixtape and the BAM Cinema Fest of 2 years ago make incredible. And Bob, I object to that word because I never want to give incredible reports. You know what I'm saying? I want people to believe it. But anyway, it says here, make incredible use of Fass's personal archives, a priceless trove of first-person political reportage, early interviews with 60s icons Bob Dylan, Abby Hoffman, and other far-out, well, here I differ, ephemera, to craft this unforgettable documentary. Bob, you know, when I was, when I found myself in times of trouble, you shared...
When you were in what trouble?
When I found myself in times of trouble, Brother Bob came to me and said, let's talk to Bob Dylan. And I said, let it be. Remember that? It was a great moment in my life.
Well, you were right. You were with the last time we spoke to Bob Dylan on the air. You asked him the question that made him say, well, I got to go.
Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, you said, what exactly did you mean by everybody must get stoned?
I can't believe I did that to Mr. Dylan.
And he said, well, I got to go.
Yeah, yeah. A good answer, actually. It's just as enigmatic as his entire body of work. It was a beautiful reply, actually,
well,
if you think about it poetically.
He stopped the recording session to talk to us. That was really kind of him.
Yeah.
And Steve Benisrael was with us.
I was about to say that. Our lost brother, Steve Benisrael. Well, he wasn't lost. He found us. Bob, I know I spoke about him a week or two ago, but... I give you this moment for our mutual friend, but your better knowledge friend, Steve Benisrael.
Well, I should be really happy now because of the movie, and every so often, more often than I like even, I see or hear or think of something that reminds me of him. Like, my eyes begin to burn, and I think of how many moments he was on the air with us at BAI when he escaped from Brazil, and he helped to organize a letter campaign to free the other members of the Living Theater who were being shown the instruments of torture in Brazil. Sam Melville letters from Attica. I don't know if you ever heard that piece he did with Frederick Shevsky, the great composer of The People United Shall Never Be Defeated. Frederick Shevsky wrote a piece called Attica, based on the letters of Sam Melville. Sam Melville was somebody who was part of a group of underground warriors who blew up the draft board downtown in Manhattan without injuring anybody. Steve did a piece based on those letters that is chilling, as you can hear the boredom and the incessant brutality and the experimental chemistry and terrible food prison, and how he keeps trying to hold himself together. I think that was the name of the piece. I remember when he said, you know, you heard of, I'm sure you've been following the Rent Guidelines Board. Steve said, of all of the animals in the world, the human being is the only one that pays rent. And other insightful and wonderful things. Remember when, I know you've seen him perform, but you remember when he says to the audience, what happened to all those people who were standing up and shouting, we won't take it anymore, in the 60s? He says, they're sitting in your seats.
He was brilliant.
And he said, if not now, when? Well, get busy. Or words to that effect.
Bob, in your love of Steve Ben Israel, you humbly omitted to confess that you were contemporaries in Judith Malina's Living Theater.
No, we were not.
Not contemporaries, but you were both there.
Living Theater at the same time, but we were never in the same company, except at Three. We were in the same company at Threepenny Opera.
But, well, what made you all so bleeping weird about that experience at the Living Theater?
So weird. How do you mean that?
By that I mean populist, but conventionally characterized there as.
Judith comes from, you know, a tradition that encompasses wonder rabbis and German existential playwrights and. She and Julian Beck formed this non-violent group of artists called the Living Theater. I came from, I guess, more like a neighborhood playhouse actor's studio branch of theater, and some of the acting styles were quite different, but I thought she was a wonderful, wonderful theatrical artist, and a lot of ways more talented than her great husband, Julian.
Bob, did you know that both she and I shared an award from the Humanist Society, the Church of Humanism?
I wouldn't be surprised to hear that.
I
wouldn't put it past you.
I don't know what I did. But I was some years ago, Reverend Joseph Ben David, a colleague of Hannah Arendt. Another liberator, as you well know, Bob.
Yeah.
And
I should tell you something else.
Yeah.
That might be unsettling to you.
Sorry, that's all the time we have tonight.
Go ahead.
Say what?
Chris Albertson is in the movie.
Yeah, well. No comment. Obsession is its own obsession. I'll leave it at that, okay?
Robert, I have an opinion about Chris Albertson that's based on knowing how for years he seethed with resentment at the bad way that Pacifica treated him. And it's unfortunate that you're the recipient of the venom that he's stored up. He doesn't even know that he's venomous, you know. I'm sorry, but please don't take it any more personally than you take the chanter or poor Monroe or Lynn Samuels, for that matter.
Lynn Samuels was my friend, and she understood the station. She understood who the affiliates were. She knew what WPFW was, and I consider her a great, beloved, late friend of mine.
Well,
and she never worked for U.S. military intelligence.
She what?
Lynn Samuels, as far as I know, never worked for U.S. military intelligence.
Worked for me at military intelligence?
She never worked for U.S. military intel.
As military intelligence,
and was able to somehow violate the precedent of no non-American nationals being employed by U.S. Armed Forces Radio, like the person you mentioned.
Oh! You say that Chris worked for Armed.
I am Batman. I've studied this.
That may very well be that all may very well
leading
be true.
To his later entry into the United States.
That all may very well be true. I just know that.
And someone who never actually had to develop a budget of the magnitude we face here today at WBAI, because the rent was paid by the progenitor of BAI. So at the time that someone claims to have been a great manager, there was not a great challenge comparable to that which we face today that by some people is attempting to be undermined.
Well, I think...
By some people. I think some nostalgic people.
I wonder if you'll allow me to respond.
Of course, Bob.
That we certainly do have a larger budget, and our audience is in worse shape economically than it was. For instance, there are not that many people who are, say, working at night and listening to the radio. A lot of those nighttime jobs have moved to places where people were, making a living by picking up the garbage that they were forced to live in. You know, the dubious pleasure of alienated work has been spread around the world since we were on the air then. But Chris when he was the manager, he was doing his best to keep the station afloat in whatever way.
Yes, at which time he had only to raise 15% of our current budget.
Yeah,
15%.
But that's true. But it was in in 60s dollars rather than in 21st century dollars. It's about a third.
You know, I did not call for a boycott of WBAI when I was in exile.
What's that?
I did not call for a boycott of BAI. I supported the station when I was insecure. But not everybody does that at such times.
Well, I did when I was.
I admire you for that, Bob.
I was wrong. I did call for a boycott, and I was wrong. But
well, you know what unites you and me.
Is that we love and support the station.
Please
let me finish what I was saying. Chris is a very, very bad enemy. When he is angry, there is no reasoning with him. I had a conversation with him where I said, you know, we have this disagreement, Chris. When someone is beginning to do a job, or when you're teaching a child to swim, if the child, and I don't mean to say that you're a child, but you were doing two jobs at different times of the day, and you were trying to break a new audience in on a different kind of program, and sometimes I had a feeling that you, when you were trying to complete the last lap, your form wasn't so great. You were like the kid who is trying to swim. And what do you say when a kid who's trying to swim doesn't swim perfectly? You say, that was good. That was good. Next time it'll be even better. If you tell a kid that was terrible, next you're drowning yourself in this and the station. All you're doing is making an enemy, and you're not helping at all. I listen to your program sometimes with pleasure, and sometimes I think it's going to be better next time. My program is the same. Every time I go on the air that I try to do something that didn't work out, I have a feeling that I'm going to, have a chance to try again to do something a little bit better. And I have very little patience for people who say, that stinks, because it's not helpful. My acting teacher used to say, don't pay any attention to your critics, because even when they say you were wonderful, you were just wonderful, you'll know that there was something that you were doing that you could have done better.
Well, Bob, I believe that being involved with WBAI over the long period of history of one's octogenarian life, or however long we may have on this earth, means something better and higher than a suicide pact.
Than a what?
A suicide pact, a matter of mutual self-destruction in which one cannot accommodate the love, but only express the resentment.
Absolutely. 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 We have some tremendously talented people who worked at WBAI.
Of course.
Larry Josephson says some people leave, and some people leave angry, and some people leave very angry. And that's the history of this place. We're in the business of the continuing revolution. And
well, actually, that's placing us into history. When people think that the narcissism of a moment of imagined glory is that which requires the destruction of its subsequence.
Well, that's pointless. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, Bob.
Pointless and stupid.
QED, my point exactly in regards to things we were talking about before.
Well, Robert, we ought to take a long walk on the beach sometime. There's a lot to talk about.
By the way, Chris Albertson hired you, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Hi.
Yes, he did. I mean, he didn't hire me the first time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was...
I'm not sure which one of us has been fired and rehired more times here at VA. But I just wanted to put that on the record.
Well, you know, it's hard to... it's hard for people like us to mesh with bureaucracies, I think. But,
amen, brother. But I heard.
BAI,
I heard that.
BAI is more tolerant of people like us than, say, Sirius or any other place where we could do what we do. And I'm happy to be associated even with some of the people that I've had, terrible disagreements with over the years.
Bob, I am so honored to be associated with you. I think you are a genius of the galactic class. In the form of Freeform Radio.
Oh, well, so are you then. If I am, then so are you.
I'm merely a black hole.
No, I don't think so. I felt like that, though, once, as though a lot of things were swirling in toward me. But,
You were the subject also of some fabulous novels in the Romain en Clef. Of some of your very exciting days. Do you remember that?
Let's see. There was Anita Hoffman's...
Exactly. I love that book.
Trashin, which was... It's a science fantasy about the Yippies.
It was a beautiful book. I loved it.
There's not really a lot of truth in it, but it's... it was good mythology.
It'll do. Until the truth comes around.
But... everybody has the right to think of themselves as, I don't know, like precious and unique. And I listen to, everybody on BAI, and there's always some spark of something that would make a fantastic, I don't know, compelling and something that would inspire people to live like a kind of a more principled life, Chris Koch is going to be in this movie.
Oh, the guy who was censored under that administration, that person you mentioned.
Well, I think he sees it differently now.
Because he was reporting about the truth of the war in Vietnam and went there and repeatedly censured by Chris Albertson.
Well, Chris may have even known that he was there. The board of
I say this not just off the top of the head, but that's the actual testimony of Chris Koch.
Well, when did you talk to Chris last?
He published about it.
Many times, but I think in retrospect, he thinks that the two of them were kind of pointed at each other and said, let's you and him fight.
Well, I see it a different way, Bob. Bob, excuse me. I see it a different way. There are some people who attack the conduct of U.S. wars abroad and who oppose the proponents of those wars domestically. And that is what I see in common with some things that I might have done and some things that Chris Koch might have done that received equal ire from some quarters.
Well, Chris didn't get... No one really complained about what Chris did. Even Chris Even Albertson didn't complain about what Chris did.
That is not my reading of the record as stated by Chris Koch.
Well, I was there. I was there.
And so was Chris. And by that I mean so was Chris Koch.
Yep. Robert, lots of times things happen at BAI where the people who are pulling the strings are outside the station. I'm sure you know that.
I know that, and there are people who oppose our opposition to war.
We were getting to be too popular, and we were too fresh, and we were smashing too many icons.
And then along comes Mary. Along comes somebody to criticize the impulse of criticizing the war, of criticizing the administration, of criticizing a president who was committing more war with more forgiveness than ever before.
Well, that's not what happened then, Chris. Chris Koch and Dale Miner did a fantastic series called This Little Light of Mine. And Chris Koch borrowed my tape recorder to go to North Vietnam.
And members I'm very of the proud board that of, you helped that.
Members of the board of directors were terrified that the State Department, who was prohibiting reporters other than the hand-picked reporter from the New York Times, whose reports weren't that optimistic about the war either, they were preventing electronic media from going there.
And when he came back, the station manager, who at that time was the person you mentioned, was censorious thereof, as was the progenitor, the donor to WBAI, who paid the rent for a manager who never had to face the challenges we do today.
Well, you have a story in you have the story all wrapped up with headlines, you know, and
where do you think I got the headlines, Bob?
I remember the nuances.
Where do you think I got the headlines, except for study?
From where?
Except from study, where do you think I got the headlines, which I'm required to say in brevity on the air?
Well, you know, I'm saying that your headlines are they're just the surface. And what was really going on at the station and in the board of directors was, it was the fear that pervaded the 50s coming out of the blacklists that led the board of directors and the people from the Center for Democratic Institutions, Halleck Hoffman and those others, from believing that BAI could get away with sending a reporter to North Vietnam. And then when they heard the reports and they compared them with the Agence France press reports, which were quite accurate as to what was going on, which Chris Albertson, procured for the station with...
And then censored when Chris Koch was reporting from his firsthand trip to Vietnam.
They didn't. They agreed completely that it was not a surprise to people who listened to BAI to know that the Viet Cong were popular with the people of South Vietnam, for instance. It was not news to the BAI audience, but the board of directors was afraid that this would get to the attention of the State Department, and actually, it was really hardly a blip. When we did a program with a defector from the FBI at that time, we also were terrified.
So management at the time engaged in self-censorship needlessly.
So
it was a needless self-censorship imposed by management.
Right. Well, Albertson, I guess, told me that he was thinking of resigning when that pressure was put on him to ask Koch for his reports prior to broadcast. Actually, they had
which as a reporter and a journalist, I find anathema.
Of course, pre-censorship is an anathema. But people between 1960 and 2012, people have had to fight to make that an anathema. It was the run of the mill every place else.
Well, this is Pacifica, this is WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and that is Bob Fass. And Bob Fass is one of my enduring heroes of radio broadcast.
Well, Robert, it's been terrific to talk to you. And I think we should do more of this stuff.
I'm amazed that we did this. characteristic of your frankness. I love this.
I was so chilled when I heard that report you did with Michael Ratner this afternoon. And when I heard Amy talking to him early in the morning, I thought this is something that has to be, you know, gotten out. That we are entering a time when we're going to have military trials of civilians. They have a whole different set of procedures in military trials. You know, they're not like civilian courts. They're not even like civilian courts. And civilian courts are bad enough.
Bob, I am here to celebrate the rare cherry on top of the cake and ice cream cone that is the beauty of your life, the very small part of it that can be encapsulated in film, in the premiere in New York, if I understand correctly, of Radio Unnameable at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, on the 26th, n'est-ce pas?
7 o'clock. If you want a ticket, you'll have to go to the BAM website.
Mm-hmm.
To order it, and you can get tickets for the benefit of BAI as well.
Well, Bob, we think that you have more than earned this honor, this accolade. You are my hero. And everything I do with you is about learning, whether it's about admiration or confrontation. You are truly a genius of radio, and I love you, man.
Same here, Robert. Take care of yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bob Fass, BAM, on the 26th, here in New York at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they pick, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you. Of tender years, can't know the fears that your elders grew by. And so please help them with your youth.
receive the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
You cannot know. This is Earthwatch. I've been Robert Knight. Thanks to Michael Ratner, and thanks to Bob Fass. Go see the documentary about Bob Fass called Radio Unnameable at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And let me say that this is WBAI, Pacifica Radio in New York, and coming up in just a moment, through the graciousness of Jim Freund, is the inimitable Hour of the Wolf program. Hi, Jim.
I wanted to say one thing.
Yeah.
That you mentioned the Nina Hoffman book and all that. That's 80s. In the 70s, in science fiction, was the Illuminatus trilogy that pointed out in the very first Illuminatus book that the true information that was going out to everybody went through Radio Unnameable. Let me just so we had it first.
Get out.
We the science fiction
you mean
people
like
knew
Robert
the
M. Tom Wilson and all them people?
The science fiction people knew the power of Fass before the mainstream writers of the '80s. That's all I wanted to say.
I knew Bob Fass when I was a zygote or whatever you call that stuff. He's my hero. Yeah.
Zygote. That's a planet I'm not familiar with. Well, Zygothians, I guess.
Well, you are wearing black. You're a little bit gothian.
Yeah, slightly goth. Slightly goth.
Come on, let's show people the magic of radio.
Oh,
as
we
do
geez.
The changing of the mics.
Oh.
The changing of the mics. This has been Earthwatch. Email me. I'm Robert Knight, RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. Thank you for having the courage to listen tonight. I love you all. See you next week.
Okay, now, you see, I need to start Hour of the Wolf, and I have a guest on recording and all that, but you can't do it without talking about Fass, because we are, all of us who do, okay, not only all of us who do free
I'm now on
radio,
the other mic.
But all of us that do any radio here at WBAI owe Fass this incredible debt of existence.
He's like white radio jazz. He's an improvisationalist of the first order.
I mean, the concept of how radio began, one can follow. It's not just the history of WBAI, although that is important enough. You cannot write the history of radio without writing about Fass. It's not possible. You cannot do it. I won't even say thorough. I mean, you know, bullet point, even on a bullet point level.
He is the ring pass knot of freeform radio.
Very much so. I mean, there was, which is, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, the whole premise, original premise behind Pacifica Radio. There are those people, I think a lot of people rewrite what it's about. They say, oh, it's free speech radio. No.
No.
It's
the charter is very specific.
Yeah, that's correct. That is correct. Robert knows what he's talking about. Very few other people do. It is not about only listener sponsorship, because that was...
It's about creating an independent funding base.
It's about that, but it was also about that it was the first time ever that the person behind the microphone actually thought of the words that person was going to say. Everything else beforehand was scripted. And that was the second part of Lou Hill's grand vision. And actually on my website at ourwolf.com, I have a link to On the Theory of Listener-Sponsored Radio, written by Lou Hill. It's 1948, where Pacifica already exists, KPFA already exists. And he's written this monograph about what the KPFA pilot experiment is all about. It's a fascinating thing. And there you will read that what he's writing about is the fact that everything else on radio is scripted. The person behind the microphone is reading what somebody else has written. What makes Pacifica Radio different, what made Pacifica Radio different, aside from listener sponsorship, listener sponsorship was the way to allow this kind of radical radio to occur.
There is a term that is used in regard to the regulation of media, in which the containers use the word responsibility. And you see, I'm dyslexic, Jim, and I misspell that word. And I separate it into the words responsibility. And the only way that a live terrestrial broadcast can have response
or ability broadcast.
Well, no, that's mostly the FM, because the AM gets damped out, but it's the FM which goes horizontally.
You're right.
I've studied this, 8 minutes to Pluto or whatever it is. No, 13 hours to Pluto, 8 minutes to the sun. And responsibility requires that the enactor on the microphone has the fealty to the institutional mission and the freedom to do jazz, to improvise on behalf of that mission at the moment of contact.
Exactly, exactly. Because what happened was that in the formation of Pacifica with Lou Hill came the idea that the person could think, perhaps in advance, perhaps their own script, but that was the author. This is where FAS comes in. In other words, let's say that Lou Hill introduced original classical music. FAS did jazz.
Yeah.
How's that?
Which is indigenous American classical music.
Bingo. Bingo. So we're going to consign FAS. He's not Stravinsky. He's Ellington.
I'm not an actor. I only play one on the radio.
There you go. There you go. So I think that's a fair metaphor. I really do. And I think that everything that the very fact of conversation, of segue, and all that that goes on, especially on late night radio here in WBAI, all stems from FAS.
And I admire him because Bob had almost as much courage as the people who listened tonight.
Almost.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Robert. So tune in, by the way, not only go to the movie and all that, tune in tomorrow night at midnight, Thursday night
for
at midnight.
What?
Radio.
I forget.
I don't have a name.
The name of it.
I can't think of what it's called. It just doesn't occur to
me. I'll call Cabal.
That's it. The Cabal. Thank you. And speaking, this is not Cabal, this is broadcast.
This is Hour of the Wolf.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us tonight, by the miracle of science, through recordings and various means, we will hear from Genevieve Valentine with a movie review, an interview, and a reading. Stay tuned. Genevieve Valentine is a polymath of a woman. She is a superb writer of science fiction. She is a wonderful and strange blogger of things about movies and life. Well, what she is something that if you just stay tuned for the next hour and 15 minutes, you will find out more. But one of the things that she is, as well as of within a minute from now, is she is a WBAI movie critic. I hope to be placing her movie reviews in any number of places on our airwaves. There will always be a space on Hour of the Wolf. And it's noteworthy, by the way, that I wonder if Bob Fass ever knew Andrew Saris. Andrew Saris was one of the great movie critics, or terrible movie critics. He was one of the most important movie critics. How's that? I disliked. I mean, one's supposed to disagree with these people, although his original review of 2001 A Space Odyssey angered me a great deal when I mentioned that to Genevieve earlier tonight at the KGB Fantastic Fiction readings. She basically took the Fifth Amendment. She had no comment. But Saris was an interesting, complicated person, and he, like Pauline Kael, was a critic at WBAI. Actually, I think Kael was on one of our West Coast stations, but Saris was WBAI. He wrote the official review for WBAI of 2001, A Space Odyssey. If you should ever read the making of 2001, you will see Andrew Saris at WBAI. And sadly, Andrew Saris passed away today, or I should say Tuesday, and was reported Wednesday. And he was in his early 80s, and that is a shame. And on at the same time that he leaves us, a new voice is being heard, and that is that of Genevieve Valentine with a movie that opens today, as a matter of fact, at the IFC Center. And, well, let her tell you about it. That is, if our technology will work. Here it goes.
Hi, I'm Genevieve Valentine, bringing you an indie documentary review.
Stop!
What? Oh, no!
Oh, my God. How many times did I edit and re-edit that? Oh, my God. I am so embarrassed. You know what? Okay, obviously I have the unedited version, which is ironic because I emailed her the edited version. So we're going to hear the edited version a little bit later. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to go straight to the interview. This interview, which has not yet been broadcast, occurred the night of the Nebula Awards. Genevieve wrote an amazing novel, her first novel, entitled Mécanique, a novel of the Circus Trisalti, which has been described justly as circus punk. And her first novel out, she was nominated for the Nebula Award. The Nebula Award is similar to the Academy Award insofar as that it is a peer award given out by the Science Fiction Writers of America. And the Hugo Award, which is the better known award, is a popularity award. It is voted on by the fans. And if you want to vote in the Hugos, you can. All you have to do is join the World Science Fiction Convention as supporting membership or attending membership, and you can vote for the Hugos. But to be a voter on the Nebula Awards. I'm a member of Science Fiction Writers of America, but I am what's known as an affiliate member. I don't write. I haven't met the requirements of 3 stories published. I've technically had 2.5 stories published. And we, so only working writers get to vote on this award. And first time out, she was nominated. So the evening before, I conducted about 12 interviews at the Nebula Awards in Washington, D.C. this year. And, well, this is one that occurred the night before the awards were actually presented. If this weren't digital, we'd be rolling.
Okay.
As it were, but we are recording. It is Friday evening, sometime in May of 2012. I've got to look it up, right?
We're off the grid in a small motel just outside of nowhere. Last desperate broadcast.
Exactly. Which should be May 18th. Thank you. It's the Nebula Award. It's really a cool thing if a director's first movie gets nominated for Best Film. And it is ultra cool if one's first novel is nominated as Best Novel.
It is ultra cool. It is also ultra unexpected. When Kate Baker...
I was going to ask you to tell the story in excruciating detail.
Oh. I was at my day job, and Kate Baker called me. It was the day before I was leaving for Boscone. And she called me and said, "Can you talk for a minute?" And I said, "Is this about the Clark's World group reading?" And she goes, "No, it's the Nebulas." And I went, "Well, what about them?" And she said, "You're nominated for one." And I said, "What?" Which was the extent of the phone call. I actually think I hung up on her at that point because I was so nervous, and she had to call me back and give me the details. It was a marvelous
When you told it live on the air, you made it more excruciating. But
it was excruciating at the time, but now it has faded.
And the worst part was that because you were going to Boscone,
I couldn't tell anyone. So I had to wander around Boscone, not spilling the beans, for 3 days.
With this look on your face, no doubt.
And as it turns out, a total inability to keep a secret.
Oh!
I spilled the beans the second night I was there by accident when Kate asked if I still had her phone number. And I said, "No, I got so nervous when you called me about the thing that I erased my call history." And we turned to the unnamed person who was with us, and the unnamed person said, "Good cover." And I was like, "Thank you." It was unintentional. I really had every intention of keeping a secret, but things happen.
Mécanique is an amazing novel.
Thank you.
Did you see the write-up, by the way? There was a newspaper
out-of-town paper. I tweeted it, and actually Todd put it up on the CEFWA website. I'm trying to remember what paper it was from.
The Millions.
The Millions. Yes, it was the website the Millions. And they did a summary review of all the nominations. And let's just say that you fared well.
Nice.
Describing Mechanique as circus punk.
I like that. I think that that is a very fitting moniker. I feel like that...
I agree with it, actually. And they did, I thought, a very fair summary.
Okay.
Of what the book is. But I know you've done this on the radio before, but here we... This is also for, you know, the record, as it were.
Okay.
And the Millions.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about Mechanique.
Are we doing this seriously or facetiously?
Seriously.
Oh, all right.
I'll tell people, I was at the launch party and it was cool.
I will forever love that launch party. I feel about that launch party the way some people probably feel about their weddings.
Mm-hmm.
But we will talk more about that later.
Okay.
Mechanique takes place in a post-apocalyptic landscape where city-states are constantly at war for reasons that they don't quite understand themselves. The only thing that transcends all of these self-made borders is the Circus Trisalti, which is a seemingly ramshackle circus that, once it starts, has an enormous power over the people who are watching as they come to realize that what they are watching is not human. What exactly they are, who exactly is in charge, and what exactly the circus requires in order to stay as it is the purpose of the book.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. Very well done. You got the... It's not the elevator pitch. It's the...
Movie trailer.
Yeah! Sort of. That's pretty good. I would say so.
Okay.
I would say so. And it's certainly a good intrigue. I mean, anybody who doesn't say, okay, I need to read that, after hearing that description, just, you know, isn't a reader.
Maybe they don't like circuses. Some people just hate them. And I understand that. As someone with several serious phobias myself, I respect that completely.
I don't have any serious phobias. Mine are ridiculous.
That must be nice. I have a large series of phobias that tends to make up the larger portion of my day.
Oh, okay. You know, I mean, I have as many or more than most people. It's just that they're stupid. So.
Did you know that there's a phobia for the feeling that a duck is watching you wherever you go?
And the name of that phobia?
I can't come up with it on the air. You know I always choke on the air.
Oh, okay. Okay. But, yeah, it's quackophobia.
Quackophobia is the fear of going to Dr. Zizmore, whose ads are on the Sunday.
Okay. I think we've just invented a great game here. It's a variant on Fictionary. That's like, name this phobia. And that's got a serious... But yes, not everybody likes circuses.
Yes.
I did as a kid. For some reason, last time I went was maybe 10 years ago to the Big Apple Circus. And I thought, yeah, all right. And I have a friend who is a clown.
Mm-hmm.
She teaches clown being and is taken very seriously. I don't know, clownery, it's... I think, in fact, the website is...
It's Gisterial Studies.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's not bad.
Well, I think that the Big Apple Circus-type circuses, the ones with the animals and all that kind of stuff, are perfect for children. Like, that gets children right in the sweet spot. And I think as you get older, you tend to be more aware of things like you're watching the elephant and all you can think is, how is this elephant being treated? Like, you know, what are the bigger issues?
And who has to clean?
Yeah, who has to clean it? And then the clowns run around and fall down for a while. And unless you're a huge Jerry Lewis fan, the appeal of that eventually fades. Which is why I'm so pleased that the resurgence of Cirque has gone up the way it has. Cirque du Soleil was an amazing ambassador for that movement. But now we're getting... things like Cirque Berserk. The circus where I held my launch party at the House of Yes, the Lady Circus, where it's sort of the darker, edgier, less polished, but slightly more dangerous seeming.
It was slightly more dangerous.
Circus.
It was like Cirque du Soleil was ballet. It was, it didn't quite do any burlesque in it, but there was the edge that they could.
And I think that the new circus has a lot of room for that. It's partially, the new circus aesthetic is partially a throwback to sort of the Victorian sideshow, you know, the beautiful curtains and the mystique and the aura as much as the acts. But the acts themselves are much more acrobatic, much more influenced by Chinese acrobatics, by contortion, by that kind of thing, than by how funny clowns can be. And I love the darker circus. I love that this new circus aesthetic has that element of danger, has that element of darkness, has the idea that this is a circus where you can see that the amount of work that goes into making it look effortless must be superhuman. And it is exactly that I wanted to talk about in Mechanique.
Yeah. And it raises all kinds of things. What reactions have you gotten from people, positive and negative? What are some of the more extreme?
I mean, I've gotten people who completely hated it for reasons I totally understand. It's not quite a book for everybody.
No, it's edgy.
The most surprising reaction I had was from my great aunt, who is in her 80s, and who got a copy of the book mostly as a family courtesy with no expectation that she would read it, and then called a few days later and went, "I read your whole book! Did you know that's pretty good?" And I was like, I am never going to get a better review than that.
No, that's cool.
So thank
Actually,
you.
Actually, that's way cool.
Thank you, Aunt Tally. That has been my favorite review so far.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, forget, like, you know, my Washington Post or anything. You know, that's... up there.
It's really hard to top, especially because I was worried that there were, you know, too many edgy, dark, weird elements, and you occasionally worry that someone will call your parents up and be like, "I read the book. What is the matter with your daughter?" And instead, nicest ever.
What circuses did you see as a kid?
My parents took me to one circus as a child that was the Big Apple type circus, and I hated it because I did not like the animals. I thought that the animals did not look like they were having a good time. I didn't enjoy it at all. And I didn't go back to it for a long time. I think until I was in college. And in college, while everybody else was out partying, I was in my room because I had discovered the internet, which I didn't have until college. And they had a TV station that would show MTV-style clips of arts performances rather than music videos. So you'd get one aria from an opera, and then a little bit of ballet, and then a little bit of a silent film, and then it would go on. And they had two acrobats, probably from a Cirque du Soleil show, doing an acrobatic pas de deux. And they started, and it didn't look at first like it was particularly physically difficult. There was, you know, the dance element at first, but I stopped what I was doing and I started watching it. And by the end of it, she's 15 feet in the air, and the amount of trust is unbelievable, and you realize that at least at 3 points in this performance, she could die.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I was like, I have to write a book about a circus. I don't know what it's going to be about, but I have to.
How many years ago was that?
Never ask a lady her age on the air.
I didn't. Oh, well, yeah, it could be traced back from there.
I wrote 10,000 words of it and put it aside because I thought it was too weird for anybody to ever want to publish.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years later, I was trying to make it in writing, and I had some short fiction out, and I had a novel I was working on, and Sean Wallace from Prime said, "Do you have a novel?" And I said, "The only thing I have is 10,000 words of this circus book that I think is too weird for anybody." And I sent them to him, and he wrote back, and he said, "Finish it, and I'll take it."
Very nice. And here we are at the Nebula Awards.
Here we are at the Nebula Awards.
And you're a nominee, and
I'm a nominee, can you believe that?
Yes, I can. I was at, I think it was actually a Capclave when I first heard you read a section of
right.
it, which I recorded, but for some reason you didn't want me to use that recording.
I was so nervous that it sounded like vibrato. It sounded like I was underwater.
I didn't notice that. I thought it was a decent reading.
Okay.
Of course, the reading that you did at the New York Review of Science Fiction and the one for Hour of the Wolf were just, you know, the best, because those always are.
Clearly, yes.
Yeah, well, of course. But it's... And, and you very kindly read different... you repeated the one you did at Capclave on
yes.
one of those occasions.
But yes,
you,
I did.
But the other time you read a different segment, and at KGB as well, I think.
KGB was a short story directly related
That's right.
to it.
Yes. Which brings up the question...
Yes.
Is this perhaps a world that you may revisit?
It is perhaps a world I may revisit. I have varied interests, so as we speak, I have three other novels, none of which are fantasy or science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But it is definitely a place that I want to go back to. So, yes, someday there will be more in the world of the Circus Trisalti, I hope.
Yeah. Dare I ask, and this is a question that one often doesn't ask a writer,
okay.
What are you working on?
That is a question that you never want to ask a writer ever.
Okay, well, no, some people you can't stop. Some people I don't ask it. They're like, let me tell you what I'm doing now!
I will take pity. I have a historical novel that is a retelling of the 12 Dancing Princesses set in 1927 New York.
Ooh.
I have a
YA. The 20s are hot.
Here's hoping. You yeah. can't see, but I'm crossing my fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm also working on a young adult near future political thriller. And I have a secondary world noirish murder mystery.
Ooh.
That's what I have right now.
Secondary world, okay.
Secondary world. Because that's not a tough sell.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was just okay, thinking, because there's New York noir... There's L.A. noir, and there's fake noir. But this is secondary world noir.
This is secondary world noir.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Very briefly, off the air, because no one needs to know about this until it sells. It is a river city in a secondary world where there's no magic element whatsoever. I just decided that what I wanted to do was create 300 years of world history and a whole geography for no reason.
World building.
World building, but for God's sake... and on New Year's Eve, a nightclub singer is murdered, and his murder ends up... The symbol of the city is a spider, and the whole idea is that his death affects a bunch of different people for different reasons, and they all start coming into conflict with each other, and it's a whole thing that I can only do by gesturing, and whatever.
Yeah, and as everybody on the radio can see.
Of course.
Okay, very good. So, okay, now time back in now.
Time in, yes.
You're making me edit this whole damn thing. So, anyway, You have not written about movies.
I have...
In fiction.
Ooh, have I never? I have. You have just not seen it yet.
Yet being the key word.
Yet being the key word. I would love to write more about the movies, but I feel like once I get started, that is a whole novel that I will have to set aside all by itself.
Yeah, because Connie Willis, who's, of course, very movie-oriented, did Remake, which is just...
Yep.
I really enjoy that book. It is crazed. It does it so well. Earlier, I interviewed John Kessel, whose novel, Corrupting Dr. Nice, is a reworking of every Preston Sturges movie plus... Bringing Up Baby and a few others set in a far future.
Nice.
Wonderful novel. I'll see if I can get you a copy. Corrupting Dr. Nice. So it's just... And these are people who are not only very influenced by the movies, but very specifically screwball romantic comedies and have worked them into their work. And I... Got the idea somewhere that you like movies.
It's so weird. I'm not sure where you would have gotten that from.
Yeah, it might have been from Fantasy Magazine. It might have been from a blog at GenevieValentine.com.
Maybe.
It might have been on Hour of the Wolf.
Who can say?
And You Owe Me Reviews. And
I do owe you reviews.
We have to tell people that I get invited. I don't know. I'm not complaining, but I'm not on the big list. I don't get to go to
don't
the big
about
movies.
This on the air. It's amazing.
I'm on the list for. I'm not complaining. I like the fact that I'm on the list for all the indie movies.
Yes.
The interesting ones. You know, let the other people fight to get to the front of the line of the latest Marvel Comics movie. I like the indies and the other little films. By the way, my current favorite recent film, The Pirates, Band of Misfits.
I have heard good things about that movie. I have not had a chance. I was busy being the only person in the theater who saw The Raven.
Oh, I'm sorry for you.
That's not true. Yeah. I'm sorry, that is not true. There were three people ahead of me in different rows, all of whom checked their text messages simultaneously every time it was a scene of Alice Eves. And normally that would bother me because she was getting fridged in a major way, and normally that has me up in arms. But she was so terrible that I would have done the same thing.
Well, was she really?
She has the emotional range of a waffle.
This is, what is it Dorothy Parker said about somebody that she saw in her Broadway show, said that she ran the emotional gamut from A to B.
Yes. Perfect. Thank you, Dorothy.
No, you can always count on Dorothy Parker.
You can always count on Dorothy Parker. You can also count on Nita Naldi. Nita Naldi had some stingers.
I don't know her.
She was an actress way back in the silence, and she was in the Barrymore, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh.
She did a couple of amazing movies with Rudolph Valentino.
There are no amazing movies with Rudolph Valentino. No, okay. Three Horsemen is good. But
how dare you?
I'm sorry.
They're not great because of him. They're great because of her.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Have you seen Blood and Sand?
No.
Okay. See Blood and Sand. That's Rudy.
Okay.
He plays a young matador. She plays the widow with her eye on him. The dialogue is so funny that they can't possibly have been saying it with a straight face as it was happening. One of them is, "But your arms, they're like iron." And at one point they have a fight where she tears the set to pieces. She throws vases and then screams and faints. And, like, she knew exactly what she was doing. It's almost fourth wall breaking, but not quite, but she did it perfectly. And in all of her interviews at the time, she had a pretty acid tongue, and was asked by a women's magazine to do a series of tips on how to keep your husband happy. And it's probably one of the most subversive works of feminism that came out that year, because everything in it, you could just see her taking an ice pick and, like, gently slamming it through someone's head. Highly recommended. I don't know how we got off on this tangent. Well, all of her movies are better than The Raven. The end.
Yeah, yeah. And the actress, I'm blanking on her name now.
Nina Naldi?
Yeah. No.
Alice Eve.
Yes.
From The Raven.
What else has she been doing?
Oh.
We were talking earlier. I think her name came up earlier today.
Not Alice Eve.
Not Alice Eve.
Oh,
okay.
Goodness. No, I'm not going to follow
her
career, even though I'm not that much of a mess.
Yeah, the point is, because we haven't said it outright, we've been hinting,
yes,
is that you write about movies. And
I
you blog
really
about
do.
Them. And hopefully you will be doing some. I have been forwarding the invites that I get to you, thinking, this is the best thing that I can do with these invites. And hopefully to get you to do some radio. Not just write about them.
Right.
You're welcome to use what I send you for blogging purposes. But I'd love some radio from you.
I would love to give excellent radio segments to you just as soon as I figure out the best way to do that.
Okay.
We will definitely be
doing that. We'll talk about that. I can make it nice and easy.
Perfect.
Yeah.
But yes, I love movies something awful, and I love awful movies something better.
Yes, exactly.
My blog feature is called Questionable Taste Theater, which does pretty much what it says on the tin.
Mm-hmm.
And